The idea behind this talk is there's, as most of you are aware, this general antagonism between science and religion that's perceived, at least. And there have been all these attempts in recent years. It seems like over the past 15 years, I've been aware of so many people working hard at trying to make peace and trying to build harmony, and yet sometimes the progress is frustratingly slow, as you know, and so it's just trying to make my little contribution that I can, opening up some new avenues of dialogue that I see possibly available, and the way I'm doing that is by first of all trying to expose, in a sense, what I see as an inherent mythic component to scientific research. And by showing how scientists routinely and often unknowingly invoke the specific language of mythic narrative to attach meaning, value, ethics, and even eschatological hopes to their scientific research. I think that presents a need for those in the faith community to aid scientists in recognizing and thoroughly examining the mythic component of their work. Secondly, I'm going to look at the critical role of naturalistic paradoxes in scientific innovation over the years, focusing in physics and astronomy because that's what I'm more familiar with, and showing how those paradoxes very closely parallel specific mysteries in Christian orthodoxy that I see. And I think this can be another avenue of dialogue where we can see how the use of established paradox, the established use of paradox to spur science forward can kind of be a model for Christians to approach their faith from a discovery-based perspective. And there are other benefits that kind of come from this. But first of all, the problem we're all aware of. Despite all the best efforts, at least in teaching, I see over and over again this presupposition of students entering the classroom that there must be this antagonism between science and faith. It's pervasive within both communities. There's rampant misconceptions within both communities, misunderstandings. We all know this. There's a lack of trust. All of these are interrelated, and this is something we're all aware of. So what do we do? I don't really know. I think the easy answer is Christian love and brotherhood, but that doesn't sound academic enough. So I have to come up with something a little more academic. And basically what comes to mind for me is opening more avenues for dialogue. So just very briefly talking about some more established conventional avenues of dialogue, and you'll have to forgive me because I'm throwing a lot of things together in maybe a way that may be a little different than what you're used to, combining some of these ideas for the sake of time. But one method that people often use is they focus on the differences between religion and science. After all, they sometimes, very often, attempt to answer different questions, perform different functions. They have different methodologies. There's an assumption of distinct realms of influence and authority, and sometimes this goes to all the way to some non-overlapping magisteria hypothesis or something of that nature. But the idea that we can look and see these distinct differences. And then the goal often becomes either a complete separation or some sort of interdependent mix, but you have this distinction that you can draw, these boundary lines that you can still draw. The dialogue then often focuses around, okay, what are those boundaries and the roles of each, and how do we keep them separate? Because they always seem to be mixing together. Or if we fit them together, how do we fit them together properly? And this becomes very difficult. There are certain topics once you get into there, it's very difficult to find a way to draw the boundaries that people can agree upon. And sometimes it's just even hard to identify a boundary to begin with. And not to say that these approaches have not perhaps yielded some benefits and might still be beneficial. But I want to kind of move on. Another approach that some people have conventionally taken is, let's just pretend like there are no distinctions. Faith and science are the same thing. And, the most radical approach would be assimilate or die. There is oftentimes then this leads to an assumption of concordism by many Christians, whereby you say, okay, well, science must be used to endorse the Christian narrative, and Christian doctrine, in a more extreme varieties of this, is used to validate or reject scientific theories. And then science, on the other hand, can come back and say, well, we can be used to explain or interpret elements of faith tradition. So if you're saying that science and faith are the same thing, then we'll just take our science and we'll explain your faith. And so the dialogue focuses around zealous scientists, oftentimes once you get to extremes, scientists explaining away religion, or Christians trying to reject certain elements of modern science. Or at the best case, if you can just happen to hit the nice point of equilibrium here, you get attempts at synthesis without destroying the foundations of either. This is difficult, but actually the first two really are not dialogue. You're not listening to the other side anymore. But it becomes very difficult when you say all there is Christianity, and so all of your science has to fit into my understanding of Christianity, or all there is in science, so all your faith has to fit into my understanding of science. Now, again, I think there are still ways that we can learn from this approach, and there are ways to do this, I think, better than is often done. There are other types of synthesis that don't necessarily involve concordism, but this is what I think is most common out there. Now, some more recent avenues of dialogue that I think are a little more hopeful in I think, bringing the two communities together, though they still have their difficulties, is let's just look at the practical issues. Environmental protection, creation care, medical ethics, ethics of military technology, social justice issues. Now, all these things... these are all areas where there's an overlap between faith communities and and scientific community, and yet it's kind of they're meeting at a third place in society where things are going on involving both. And there's still, in medical ethics in particular, as we've heard recently in some of the plenary talks, there's still it's difficult to find ways to make progress in bringing the two communities together. But I think I've seen, at least on my campus, a lot of progress in environmental protection, social justice, those types of issues, that kind of bringing those together. Now, so I want to look at some new approaches that, to me, I haven't seen presented quite this way. And what I want to do is look at where we can find similarities in science and faith, not just in the topics that they cover, but in goals, motivations, the tools, and the methodologies. Are there similar methodologies and tools? And this is where I've been set up perfectly by some presentations that were given in yesterday's workshop. For those of you who were there, you would know that was a workshop on interpreting science and scripture. And Dennis Lamoureux said in his presentation that scientists are doing hermeneutics and they aren't aware of it. Well, hermeneutics is a tool that we usually ascribe to religious scholars. Del Ratch said something, he went a lot further, and I was very impressed by his very thorough philosophical treatment of the similarities in the process of finding truth in the natural world, scientifically, and in biblical hermeneutics. And he came up with this new word, hermeneutes, or something. I suppose the unity between the two hermeneutics. And I, instead of talking about hermeneutics or metaphysical presuppositions, which a number of people have been talking about, for me it's very helpful to look at two other essential tools of the trade, myth and mystery. And by looking at those, I think we might make a little more progress getting down to these tools than maybe keeping everything at the high level language of philosophers. And you know, I may offend some people by saying that, but maybe it's just my down to earth physicist approach. But we'll see. Now, this actually, I forgot I had this quote here. This is a quote from the outline that Del Ratch had the history of our understanding, not of nature, but of science in recent decades has been a growing and grudging recognition of the extent to which other factors besides just data and reason, human characteristics, humanness, agency, and the like, function in our doing of science. So our doing of science involves these things that we normally associate with something other than science. So what I'm going to talk about first is the use of mythic narrative as a guiding framework for science and faith, and secondly, the use of paradox or mystery to spur discovery and encourage humility in both science and faith communities. So let's get on to it. So let's start with myth. What is myth? It's the way I define it, it's a narrative, a story, ostensibly connected to historical events, which contains the embodiment of an idea, belief, and or worldview. The term myth, as used here, is neutral. I'm not saying that it implies falsehoods or distortions of the truth. And in some ways, this runs counter to the conventional usage of the word myth, and yet in some ways, that is very conventional. One of my favorite programs, Mythbusters, they bring out a myth, and it can be busted, but it could be confirmed, or they could find it's just plausible. And what makes it a myth is there's a story behind it. That's what makes it a myth, not that it's false. So that's the way I'm using this term here. Mythic language, then, is language that's used to invoke narrative imagery in order to convey a message. And mythic language, I think, first I want to impress the idea that this is one of the primary methods of communication for many religions, including Christianity, and has had, I think, from my perspective, a resurgence of popularity in modern times. Where I work in chapel, we hear all the time about joining the story of God. It's almost become a little mantra at our university. And it's sort of replaced things like accepting Jesus as my Savior, which doesn't invoke a narrative imagery, at least not to me. There's this idea of a narrative arc to God's work throughout history. And this, again, I go back to a talk that was given yesterday by Kevin Van Hooser. He gave a very convincing argument for understanding Christianity is a great theater play, with scripture playing the role of script and transcript, the idea of narrative describing Christianity. Now, many theorists of myth have contrasted mythic expression with scientific language, the latter being identified as the only concrete avenue to discover truth. And for this reason, it's become commonplace in modern times to invoke scientific language in defense of religious positions, even those having little to do with empirical investigations of the natural world. And those involved in religious studies, I think, feel pressures on occasions to make appeal to scientific reasoning or inductive reasoning as some sort of impartial authority whom all can agree to respect. But I think it is less obvious that the language and objectives of religion are consistently being employed by scientists. And more specifically, what I see is the mythic narrative, the universal language for religious studies. It can be found surrounding the most significant achievements in science. So I reviewed some sample science press releases from research universities, organizations like NASA, JPL, professional scientific associations like AAAS, from the last 6 months, restricted to physics and astronomy because that's what I'm more familiar with. And here's another quote. I'm just going to skip over that. It's some of you probably have seen this before anyway, from Polanyi. It's, again, just another one talking about these elements of science that go beyond simple reason and inductive empirical investigation. Okay, so this is what I looked at. I looked at mythic language in these press releases, and yes, this was just this communication to the outside world, but to me, it's indicative of the way that scientists think about the work that they do. I looked at these, and I tried to draw up these categories. I was looking for articles that just had little or no mythic language in them, ones that made connections to stories, mythic scenes, and or a larger narrative, ones that had clear references. This is what I saw a lot of phenomena or natural laws as being alive and living and dying and doing things like that. Ones that were referring to natural phenomena and laws as having this added value and purpose that you normally wouldn't associate with just a law or a phenomena. References to these phenomena as having motives and desires, quite a few of those. And then occasionally you'd see cases where the natural phenomena or laws were cast as heroes or villains for a larger cause. Now, to me, this is very telling. It reveals the power of narrative language in addressing meta-empirical questions, and mythic language clothing the scientific data in larger claims of significance. And it's tempting to just decry such practices, but it's my contention that in science, science cannot exist in its current form and practice without the narrative or mythic context in some form. And I contend that the vast majority of scientists share this implicit, though unrecognized often, assumption that good science must simultaneously involve both good empirical methodology, objective and repeatable observation, and a good story or myth associated with it. The story must have explanatory power and be philosophically satisfying. The myth serves a purpose of motivating and inspiring further research. It can often be found in, I think, successful applications for research funding or popular reports that result from such research projects. And while scientists may at times publicly dismiss the use of any narrative or non-empirical embellishments of scientific research, in practice, I find they reserve their criticism for language that just does not fit their own preferred mythic framework. A mythic narrative that resonates with the accepted philosophical framework is generally not just allowed, but encouraged and applauded. And sometimes, as you start to look at this, things pop out at you. They do to me, at least. In this mythic storytelling that scientists do, equations and theories become characters and plots. Scientists become heroes. Counter-explanations and their proponents are cast as villains. And you see kind of the stock narrative that appears accompanying major scientific theories like Big Bang, Standard Model in particle physics, Neo-Darwinism. And to name a theory is to invoke its associated symbolic story. They often fit together in a larger meta-myth that of scientific meliorism or the advancement of human rationality. And you have these heroes of the past, like Galileo and Copernicus, invoked symbolically often with shameless disregard for historical accuracy at times. And there's even references to almost eschatology, the ultimate attainment of scientific enlightenment. Now, I'm going to look at some examples real quickly. The Copernican myth is one obvious one that you're pretty familiar with. For the sake of the time, I'm going to go over these pretty quickly. Here's a story where you have not just the facts of history of Copernicus's his idea that the sun is the center of the solar system that changed the thinking of scientists, but you have this idea that that Copernicus was dethroning mankind and showing that we are in no way special. Along with it comes kind of a general Copernican myth that says there is no way that we can be special, and that everything we discover in science is going to help us discover how unspecial we are, how meaningless life must be. And there've been a number of people who've gone into this in more detail. Danielson is one who comes to mind, or Danielson rather. He has done a treatment on this. The ETI myth is one that Ted Peters has written about, talking about astrotheology and the idea of that many scientists have of just assuming that life is going to pop up everywhere in the universe that it can. It's going to evolve in similar ways it does on Earth, that this seeking extraterrestrial life is kind of a way of attaining enlightenment for humanity. And there's a whole kind of mythology that goes with that. There's the unification myth, the idea that you have theories that must unify together. We've seen the success of this. And again, I'm not trying to say that all of these myths are entirely wrong and bad and evil. The idea is that they're there. And so the unification myth is one that I actually like in many ways. You look and you see how things like waves and particles and energy and matter and space and time, and all these things were thought to be very separate, and we start to unify them one by one by one, and we see how everything starts to connect together. Electricity and magnetism and was separate. Maxwell comes and unifies it, and it fits together in a story arc that goes throughout the past few hundred years, leading up to a point now where I think in the current climate, there's no way that you could contribute. There's no way that you could make your mark as the next Einstein as a scientist without providing a unifying, beautiful equation as a hero. You could make all sorts of contributions to science, but I don't think you're going to make that real mark that Einstein made unless you provide a unifying, beautiful equation, because that's what people are looking for to fit into the narrative, whether it's there or not. So how do we dialogue? I think, ideally, scientists should welcome input from faith communities and helping them construct their science stories and communicating them to non-scientists. And we need some ground rules for this, where integrity cannot be compromised for the sake of the myth. And that's what occasionally happens. Details should not be casually discarded because they run counter to the mythic framework. And the myth should not be confused with the science that it surrounds. Randomness does not equal meaninglessness. The meaninglessness is the idea associated to the mathematical idea of randomness has something that's associated with it that doesn't necessarily have to be. Now, for sake of time, I'm going to have to go on to the next rather rapidly here. Parallel paradoxes is the next avenue of dialogue that I see opening up. And what interests me about this is when we look at paradoxes, and here I'm using paradoxes to mean apparent contradictions, not necessarily real contradictions or inconsistencies, but apparent contradictions that I'm looking at ones that are not particularly easy to resolve. Now, some paradoxes have clear solutions. We talk about the twin paradox in relativity, and that's easily resolved. We still call it a paradox because of the apparent contradiction, but there are other ones like Schrodinger's cat paradox, which is not so easily resolved. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it won't be. I think that they're important because I think searching to resolve paradoxes leads to new and beneficial discoveries. And we can tie this in with a concept in Scripture that we see of mystery. It's used quite often, particularly in the New Testament. And when you look at it, it's not something that we have no access to, a mystery, something just completely beyond us, but it's often implying a hidden knowledge that's eventually revealed or discovered or to be revealed. Used to describe God's character, methods of interaction, and intentions for the future. So there's some similarity going on here. Now, I'm going to draw some side-by-side comparisons here, and I'm going to go through them pretty quickly here. But in putting these together side-by-side, I'm not saying that one describes or links in a one-to-one fashion with the other, but I'm just trying to show some parallels. In science, we have the fourth dimension, which is very difficult to understand in many ways because there are these paradoxical elements to it. There are many theories, established theories of science, that suggest that time has a direction to it and time must flow. And then there are other aspects of science, theories of science, that suggest a block view of time where that time, perhaps, the flow of time does not even exist. It's a very paradoxical situation and has confounded many scientists. In religion as well, we have a similar problem with understanding what is time? What does it mean when we say God is outside of time? Augustine even wrestled with this problem. How can we even imagine something outside of time? I can't imagine it. So does it have any meaning for us? It's a paradoxical mystery. And it's been, I think, what interests me is that it's popped up in modern science and it's been around in Christian orthodoxy. Wave-particle duality. The idea that something can be both a wave and a particle defies imagination, but the existence of this wave-particle duality is not in doubt, says Paul Davies. I would agree. It's very hard to understand how something can have both those characteristics, and yet that's part of the established theory of science that we have. Thank you. We also have in Christian Orthodoxy the idea of the Trinity, which, according to Heinlein, so anyone who can worship the Trinity and insist that his religion is monotheistic can believe anything. Well, you know, we've gotten so used to it, I think some of us forget that that is actually a paradoxical concept. It's difficult in many ways. Now, again, paradoxical doesn't mean it's contradictory or inconsistent. It just means that it is a mystery. And I think there's nothing wrong with calling it a mystery and realizing it for what it is, and what that should do is kind of make us think hard and long about it. Now, also in science, we have causality and uncertainty. Now we're getting into quantum mechanics here. You have this quote by Feynman that I love, because it's basically an argument over whether science can even accommodate this idea. It's so paradoxical. And the debate actually still rages as to what this means, and we don't really know. Likewise, there can be a similar difficulties when we get to free will and divine sovereignty in Christianity. People can really get into hang-ups on that. Now, does that mean that there has to be a contradiction here? No, but I think that there is a real significant mystery here. That to me, it's interesting to see how much it parallels the paradox and mystery we see in science. I think I'm about out of time, so I'm just going to put these up here and talk about them quickly. The chaos and order, we see in chaos theory how patterns emerge and a type of indeterminacy emerges out of strict law. And we have this tension between grace and law in Christian tradition. We have the question of anthropic tuning. I talked about the Copernican myth. We are seen as just little specks in the universe, and yet the universe is fine-tuned for us. That's very paradoxical. We have been made to glorify God. God takes pleasure in us, but what is man that God thinks of us? Why does God care? And interpretation, this circles back to the idea of narrative context. We must interpret our data, and yet that interpretation itself seems to compromise the scientific enterprise at times. That's a paradox. And I see in Christianity the idea of relationship sometimes being a bit of a mystery. You know, if I see someone who had all prophetic powers, understood all mysteries and all knowledge, and had the faith to remove mountains, it'd be really hard for me to say, who cares if they're not loving? You know, I'd be likely to be very impressed by that person. And I think that's a tension that we have in Christianity, that, yeah, we understand that relationship is what it's all about, and yet we also understand that we are supposed to be growing in knowledge, and it's a bit of a mystery as to understand what that all means. I'll just throw this up here, and I think that what can result out of this is a common humility and a common search for discovery. And I'll just leave it at that, because I think I'm out of time. So,
thank you very much. Robert, are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. Robert Geddes is going to...